Welcome to the DDT Archives. I am your host, Chris. With me, as always, my tag team partner in podcasting, my best friend, everybody's best friend, Greg. Greg, what's going on, man?
Living the dream, my friend. How are you?
Oh, it could not be a better dream tonight. We have an 18-time tag team champion.
Oh, my God.
A New York, New Jersey legend, a Jersey All-Pro Hall of Famer, and one of my absolute favorites in the Jersey independent scene. With us today is Monster Mac. Monster Mac, how you doing?
I'm pretty good. Thank you for the intro. What's going on with you guys? Everything all right?
Everything's great, man. Everything is really good. And I appreciate that you like the intro. I try my best to make sure that I do good ones.
I will make one slight correction. So 18-time tag team champion just is a little bit under what it really is. It's more like a 70-time tag team champion.
Like, well, you know, wrestlers' database sucks.
I'm all over the place.
I went by wrestlers' database. That is my fault.
Yeah. No. No worries.
I got to be better.
Jersey alone, because I mean, I've held titles everywhere from coast to coast, you know, worldwide. And like I said, with 10 different partners, some titles never get recognized because it's smaller companies and stuff like that. But the one thing I've always prided myself on, overall, I've held about 85 championships, singles and tag team. And the thing that I'm proud of the most is that over 70, I believe it's 75. I don't remember if it's 74 or 76, but it's somewhere in there. With 10 different partners, and like that's something that, like, how many people can say that they've done that, you know? And I'm just a local guy. I'm not anything world, you know, famous like that, but like for me that's kind of cool. And whenever I put like tag team specialist, that's one of the few things I take a lot of pride in, you know, because that's something that is awesome to me, is tag team wrestling.
And I come from a background of absolutely loving tag team wrestling. It is by far my favorite from a little kid, whether it be watching the British Bulldogs or you know, sure, all the way through to today. You know, I think some of the best wrestling in the world right now is tag team wrestling. Yep. You know, that's why I enjoy AEW, because they're putting such a focus on tag team wrestling again. And then even guys like the Briscoes and Ring of Honor tear it up all the time. They, yep, you know, and I don't think they get their due for what they do.
No,
they're fascinating. But you kind of paved the way for guys like that. You know, going back to your early days in Jersey All Pro in Ring of Honor with the Hit Squad. I remember when I was using dial-up internet, you know, and we're about the same age. Mm-hmm. So reading the results of the Jersey All-Pro matches, were, you know, you guys were absolutely the cream of the crop.
Well, we were the first tag team act on the indies that were featured in main events in various promotions. Like, our work at Jersey All-Pro put us on the map for other companies. And then once other companies started investing in Moff and myself, it just took off. And we were usually, you know, it was us, Homicide, Low-Key. We were all traveling together. And a lot of the times our dance partners were guys like the Briscoes and guys like the SAT, local guys like us, and just hungry. And, you know, for us, it was definitely... we wanted to show everybody, like, everybody looked at us, and we got called out a couple of times as being short, fat, bald guys, and we were a lot more than that. And, you know, I always thought that what made Moff and I very special was that we could go in there with anybody. Didn't matter what level of skill they had, how long they'd been in the game, we'd elevate everybody's game, and we'd make the place that we went into better than when we came into it. So, you know, we were all about that, and it happened to be tag team. We both love tag team wrestling. We love the Wild Samoans. They took us under their wing, Samu and Afa and Fatu, and, you know, Umaga and the whole Anoa'i family just loved us. And, you know, it was because of that, it pushed us even better, you know, even harder to represent and be a great tag team. And for that first 5 years, we just went on a murder spree, like we like to call it.
And it definitely was that, you know, I remember watching some of your matches and just being like, kind of had to be terrified for the other guy stepping in the ring with you. It just looked so brutal.
We got one time in Ring of Honor, the very first match we had with Carnage Crew. And I had known DeVito for a few years, and I'd known Logue for maybe 2 years. And they came from ECW. DeVito used to, you know, do a lot of WWE TV stuff back in the day. And they told us that the very first match that we had with them, our music hit. They were in the ring first. Our music hit. And they looked at each other and they said, Are we about to get into a real fight? And they were nervous. They told us, and like, I'm not trying to blow up their spot. I'm sure they'll say something about it if you were to ask them. But like, they told us afterwards that they were like, yo, we were so ready to get into a real fight with you guys. And then we got into the ring and it was all business. And they were, you know, right away from the opening bell, they were, you know, their nerves were calmed down. But, you know, we were just, we presented things on a different level. A lot of people like to, they don't like to say the word fight in pro wrestling. Whereas Moff, Key, Homicide, myself, we're all about fight. And we want you, you're paying your money to see wrestling. We want you to forget all your problems for a couple of hours. And if you have to question, what did I just see? Was that real? It's like a magician. Does he really know magic? And that's what we try to invest in, making things as legitimate as possible. Because far too many guys at the time were taking this as just, it's just a payday. It doesn't matter if we're making top dollar. And we felt that you should be, if you're in this and you're investing your body and your time, you should be making top dollar and wanting more people to come see what you're doing. So we all believe that. And there was a couple other guys with us who believe that. And we're able to transform the Northeast Indies into, you know, it was cool for ex-TV guys because they all lived in the area to come make some extra money. We made it an ocean filled with sharks, and everybody had to be good or else you couldn't swim with us. You would get eaten up, you know, and that's something that we prided ourselves on 1,000%.
How important is the leadership aspect of being in a locker room? Because obviously, if you're putting on that persona, you're showing everybody, you know, kind of leading by example. Mm-hmm. How important is that to a locker room in your career?
I actually had this conversation not too long ago. With recent online hashtag movements and stuff like that, it exposed that there's a lot of guys who, just because they're the top star, they aren't a leader. You know, everybody has said something in the past or done something in the past that's questionable. It's what makes us human. Nobody's perfect. Everybody makes mistakes. When you're younger, you do things. If, let's say you do something when you're 20 and you repeat the same behavior when you're 30 and 40, you didn't learn anything from it. But if you do something when you're 20 and you don't do it again, you obviously learn from it, and you can use that example to show the younger guys and girls how to behave. I'm not perfect by any means. You know, I try to do things where when I show the younger guys that I take them under my wing, hey, look, I messed this up. I don't want you to mess up the way I did. And you have to start that as early as possible. It's hard to when there's a lot of money involved because money corrupts everything. But when you do this for the love and when you understand that while it's a business, this is still a form of entertainment. It's not going to change the world. It's not like being a doctor or a scientist who's creating something new to save the human race. We're just here to entertain. When you can understand that and understand what your role is in that form of entertainment and understand that money isn't the root of all happiness. It's just something that you get as, you know, a reward for putting your body on the line, for making a sacrifice. When you can understand that, then it's easier to become a leader. You know, look at The Undertaker. We all watched his documentary series, I'm sure, and you could see he's got millions and millions of dollars. But if you watch the thing, he talks like he's only got like $100,000 in his bank account. You know what I mean? But you know that he's the locker room leader, because for him, it's all about the love of the business and the sport. It's not about the money. Yeah, I'm sure money motivates some things, but being the leader and being the one that everybody looks up to and respects it means a lot more to him than money. And it's kind of the same thing for us, for me anyway.
How much pride did you guys take in Jersey All-Pro? Because you see the guys that would come in and out through there, and it is legend after legend after legend. But you guys were there every show. Mm-hmm. How did that make you feel, and how great of an experience was that?
So for me, Jersey All-Pro meant a lot of things. It was home. It was a place that gave us a chance to shine and be seen. When we first started with Jersey All-Pro Wrestling, it was the land of misfits. There's a lot of people who would go to other schools in the area, and nobody wanted to touch them. Fat Frank, rest in peace, he gave a lot of us an opportunity because he felt the same way. He felt like a lot of places that he went to didn't give him an opportunity because he wasn't 6'2" or ripped up or, you know what I mean, on the gas. And when I was there in the beginning, Jersey All Pro was actually an ultra violent company. We got banned in a couple of places because they were doing light tubes and fire and all kinds of crazy stuff. And they were trying to compete with Combat Zone. Combat Zone took it to another level with the ultra violence. There was no competition there. And when that happened, Frank looked at his roster, saw us, meaning me, Mav, Key, and Homicide, and saw that we were doing things differently, and he gave us a shot, and we took the ball and ran with it. And it meant a lot of things, but the other day I was talking to somebody who's in the WWE, and he was telling me that Jersey All-Pro comes up a lot, and when it does, it's always a good mention. There's some companies that never happens, you know, and some promoters that nobody ever talks good of, no matter what they've done. But when it comes to JAP, everybody looks at it fondly, and they look at it as that was an awesome place. And there's still guys now who request, because they know that, like, I kind of had the say towards the end after Frank was gone, who, you know, they ask me all the time, what can we do to bring JAP back? And it means a lot to me because I know that I did a major part in every aspect of that company, whether it was wrestling, behind the scenes, commentary, anything, promoting. I had a large chunk of that, and it means a lot to me because that's my home, and that's always going to be my home. And that's, you know, it's cool when people who are generations younger than you talk about it like it's this legend, and you were there, and you know it, and you experienced it. And, you know, it's really cool that I can't wait for when Modtrom, the company that's behind Jersey All-Pro, the majority of their recordings, I can't wait till they get everything digitized, which they're in the process of doing, and it's out there for people to witness. When that happens, people are going to be talking a lot about JP. There were some stinkers, trust me. It wasn't all perfect, but there's a lot of stuff that, like you said, guys like Kenny Omega, Jay Lethal, Mike Awesome, Vader, Samoa Joe, Bullet Club, AJ Styles, you know, there's a lot of guys who are making a name, Keith Lee now, that Matt Riddle too, he was another guy that did JAP. Actually, Matt Riddle called out Loki there. That was the first time, and we were trying to get something started, and, you know, then things just fell apart. But all the guys now that are on NXT and AEW and, you know, everywhere you look, Impact, Ring of Honor, Japan, there's so many guys that came through Jersey All-Pro, and that's such a cool legacy. And I know that, you know, if Frank was still alive today, he would be super beaming with pride and joy that his little company that, you know, nobody had any hope for in the beginning except for him, became this giant rose that everybody loves and everybody talks about fondly to this day.
Before you came on with us, I was talking to Chris about how the first time I ever heard of Jersey All-Pro was back in like the early 2000s, late 90s, when they were on Opie and Anthony, the radio show. Mm-hmm. I don't remember specifically.
It was Louis, Frank, yeah. Ray, Pierre, I think.
And it was like, and that's when I first heard of it. And being like a wrestling fan back then, that was like, you know, early college days. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, oh man, that's so close. We got it. Like, we ended up never being able to go, but I always kept that on my radar because those guys were like heroes to me, the Opie and Anthony guys, of course. But to hear them talk about, and they always talked about wrestling very fondly. They always had guys on all the time. Mm-hmm. So to have that local flair combined with their show, that was awesome. And it's carried through, as you just said. It's really, it's like this, just like you, it's kind of like this local legend that we don't talk about enough. Mm-hmm. When it comes to how much the indie scene has boomed over the last few years. I hope that they finish getting this stuff digitized, because it'd be so much fun to go back and watch that stuff. Imagine podcasts on that, buddy. Jeez.
Oh, yeah, we'll have fun with that one.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. Just for the record, I was the one that brought Sam Roberts into professional wrestling.
Really?
Yes. We did a show where I wrestled the Dudleys up in Yonkers. And he happened to be there, and I think he was trying to get interviews. But I knew who he was, and I had invited him to Jersey All Pro because I figured, hey, you know, worst comes to worst, we have a connection with a radio show, because they were huge in New York at the time.
Oh, God.
One of their stars in the beginning. From the second he got on, they were always having Sam on. It just so happened that, you know, once we brought him in, even though the show never did anything for Jersey All Pro after that, you know, we stayed, you know, he was our commentator, he was our backstage interviewer, and, like, through that, he ended up getting a hookup, and, you know, he had a lot of practice from Jersey All Pro to now be with the WWE almost full-time,
yeah.
Which is pretty crazy, you know. Every once in a while, we'll text each other, we'll joke about it, you know. But, yeah, Sam Roberts is one of the guys that, you know, I had a hand in doing something within this business. There's a lot of guys like that, but a lot of it's not mentioned because you don't just bring up, oh yeah, when I was, you know, 10 years ago, I had Steve Back help me. You know what I mean? But like, there's a lot of guys that I've helped in this area that have become huge stars, and Sam's definitely one of them. I'm very proud of Sam. He's, you know, he's a great guy. He's an awesome dad, and he's a really good interviewer. I enjoy him. He's wacky. He's got what we were talking about before with the sense of humor. He's definitely got our kind of sense of humor.
Yeah. I remember him from when he was like the producer, and they would make fun of him because he ate like a child. I'll never forget that. Those were one of the funniest things. They would run down his diet, and they was just like, he's like, what are you, five? What, are you eating fish sticks all day? Oh, man. That's an amazing story. Wow. I'll unlock that one with my love of New York radio. Damn.
I got to go up to the studio a couple of times, and we actually got in trouble because we did an interview one time late at night, and it was when Sam had his own separate podcast. They had switched to XM, mm-hmm. and he had his own intern, and he wanted me to clothesline the intern, and I clotheslined the intern. His tooth chipped, and they put the video online, and within like 12 hours, it had like 1 million views or something like that. He had to pull it because nobody signed a waiver. So I was like, eh, go figure. The most popular thing I do gets pulled within 12 hours. But yeah, it's wrestling is weird like that. It brings together all kinds of people from all venues, all walks of life. And, you know, I've seen in my 23 years almost all of it.
That kind of leads me to your social media. Mm-hmm. Looking through it, obviously prepping for today, the who's who of people you're interacting with and you have such strong relationships with is incredible. Like, obviously you have the New York contingency in this generation, mm-hmm. still obviously has that total utmost respect for you. Diamante's birthday yesterday, and obviously the Proud and the Powerful in the picture as well. I mean, how much pride is there in just being from New York and being in professional wrestling?
It's cool that we could go to Japan, we could go to Mexico, which, you know, I've done both, and go all over. And if you're a wrestling fan, you know two things. You know, I'm representing the Hit Squad, and I represent New York. And for me, representing New York is something huge, because I grew up during the time when, like we were talking about before, the Rangers, the Knicks, the Mets, the Yankees, it didn't matter if they had horrible seasons. They were still always a contender. Now it's a little different. You know, most of the talent's gone to the West Coast or down South for all sports. But, like, you look at the Giants, you look at, except for the Jets. Jets kind of stink always, I'm sorry. But, you know, you look at the Knicks, the Nets, the Mets, the Yankees, the, you know, the Rangers, the Devils, all were always in the top eight and were always in playoff season. And for me, that meant a lot growing up. And just being from Brooklyn, like, Brooklyn is a tough place. And if you can survive Brooklyn, you can survive almost anything. I've always looked at it as it's a badge of honor to say, I'm from New York, I'm from Brooklyn. And no matter what, you know, people always have like that expectation of, you don't have the Brooklyn accent. Yeah, I don't have the Brooklyn accent, but I definitely knew Brooklyn tough. You know what I mean? Like growing up, I can remember growing, because I grew up in Bay Ridge. And I remember seeing, because we're Bay Ridge right next to Bensonhurst, I remember meeting John Gotti and thinking like, wow, this is so cool that in Brooklyn I can meet John Gotti. And then where I grew up, Tiger Woods played his first golf at Fort Hamilton golf range, golf course. And I grew up four blocks away from there. And like all these famous people grew up around where I lived. And it's kind of like, man, every once in a while I'll say, you know, it bothers me that I don't feel like I'm anybody special. But what's crazy is anybody that has my real last name, Carasquillo, I'm the most famous Carasquillo that's ever lived on this planet, which is crazy. When you think about it, in the history of this planet, I'm the most famous person with that last name. And like, you kind of have to represent. But like, sometimes I'm just Steve. I'm not anybody special. Like I said before, this is pro wrestling. It's entertainment. I'm not saving lives. I'm entertaining people. But I'm not saving. I'm not changing the world. I'm not, you know, creating anything that's going to make the human race better or anything like that. And to be honest, when I wrestle, I'm doing it for me. So like, it's like I'm representing New York in that ultimate sense of what am I doing to make people think that New Yorkers are good? So every time I'm out there, that's what we're talking about with the leadership before. That's something that I take serious because, you know, look at my guys, Homicide, LAX, Lowkey, Moff, you know, all those guys that have all J-Train that are with us and have done something. Our names are heavy, not just in New York, but everywhere because of how we act and what we've done. And a lot of it is because we're New Yorkers. It's a lot of pressure because look at all the most famous New Yorkers and all that they've accomplished. And it always comes back to, all right, so what makes you special? You know what I mean? And like, you gotta uphold that. It's kind of weird because I think only New Yorkers get that. I don't think people around the world really understand what that means because nobody, maybe guys in like Los Angeles that are in gangs. Yeah, I'm repping my set. You know what I mean? Like stuff like that. But like, I don't think people around the world really represent as hard as New Yorkers do. So I have to make sure that at all times, no matter where I put my head down, New York is, people know that's where I'm from.
See, I totally get that because having worked in like the hospitality industry my whole life, you know, I've bopped around a lot. So I've lived up in Boston. I've lived down in Raleigh. And you, especially when I lived in Boston, like I had to carry myself like that because between the jokes and the stigmas and everything like that, oh, you're a Yankee fan. Oh, you're this. But I had to show that, hey, I can hang with you guys too. Like you guys are, because, and that's such a, I want to say, New York is kind of a place where it doesn't matter where you're from. Like when we're outside of here, you represent right. But when you have people visit, you want them to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. Boston's the exact opposite of that. Boston, they hate you if you're not from there. Like they don't include you at all in anything. Yep. It's terrible. Yep. But I had to fight back. I wore my Giants tie to work every Sunday. I did not care just to mess with them. And this is post, Super Bowl wins. It's like, you know, I walked around with my Yankee tattoo on my calf in shorts and didn't mind. Like, you know, I had to because they would just eat you alive. And I didn't mind. I'd be like, I can handle this. I've been through a lot worse. Like you crazy people with your funny accents and lobster rolls. You'll be fine. I'll be fine hanging out here. Don't even worry about it.
He's got a hat on.
Yeah.
I have a hard on. No, you got a hat on. Yeah.
No, I told the story the other night. Like we had I was there only like a few months, and it was right after the Sox won in 2013, and it was opening day 2014, and the owners of the hotel gave us tickets to opening day for the managers. They had six tickets. There were seven managers in that hotel, so everyone in the meeting was like, "Well, Greg's out." I'm like, "What the." Come on. And I had to, I told him I had, I was like, they were going to draw straws to see who would go to the game. I'm just like, stop. Stop right now. I'm going to be the least disappointed if I don't win. I was like, I cannot consciously take away a World Series winning opening day where they have the flag up and the rings and the trophy there. I was like, I'm not taking that away from you guys. I'm not a freaking monster.
You should have.
No, I didn't want to go.
Ugh. What you're saying about Boston and New England, I totally get it, because when Moff and I went to go start our Beyond Wrestling run up there, I mean, it's all hardcore Providence, Rhode Island. We do a lot of shows 5 minutes outside of Boston. And I didn't think that we were going to be as over with them as we were. I know that a few of them knew who we were. And then when we started killing people, like, it became like, oh, all right, these guys are awesome. You know, the Hit Squad, the legend is real, blah, 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 right? But, like, they were, like, so in love with us, and we loved them back. And, like, we always said that, you know, we needed to have that one more match up there. It was taken away from us, but at the same time, you know, it's a goal. Like, if we ever do team up again, we definitely have to hit up New England, because the fans were, they were so passionate, and when they love you, they go all, like, there was, I'm pretty sure there's a few fans that if we got in trouble, they were willing to stab people for us, you know? So, but the total opposite happened for us in Philly. Like, we get a lot of respect in Philly, but they hate New York in Philly. Like, yeah. I've seen it where, like, they want to hop the guardrail and try to kill us. Not because we're bad wrestlers or anything like that, but because we're from New York. So
it was funny because it was one time my wife and I were newlyweds up there. And we realized one night we're hanging out with, like, after we got home from a night out with our friends, we realized that all of our friends up there weren't from there. Like, we used to call ourselves the Outsiders because, like, we hung out with this one couple a lot. He was from Detroit. She was from California. There was the other couple with the girl was from, like, Nebraska. Like, we just realized, like, none of us are from here, yet we all just hang out.
That's why you guys got along.
That's why we got along, because we understood what it was like to be, like, not welcome in this ridiculous area. And, like, my wife loved it up there. I did not fit in at all.
But that's part of being a wrestler. Yeah. You have to understand what crowd you're working in front of, what makes them tick, what do they love, what do they hate. I'll be honest, Moff was really good at reading crowds that way. He understood that if you say one thing, oh, this is a sports crowd, so you could get on them about their local teams. If this is a hardworking blue collar town, then you could talk about them being on welfare and they're going to hate you. You know what I mean? Like, he picked up real quick on it. So a lot of times I would follow his lead and then we would just go to town and try to get him to stab us, which one time almost happened, but it wasn't because of that. It was because we hit an old man with a chair and the crowd wanted us to die. So
was the old man the target of the chair?
So this is what happened. This is in Allentown for Afa, the Wild Samoans, WXW. And we were part of a group with Samu. It was me, Moff, Key, and Samu and Dylan. And there was another tag team called the Hit Squad. There was a New Jersey Hit Squad, which was us, and then their Hit Squad, which, you know, they were okay, but they weren't Moff and I. You know what I mean? Nice guys. Samu had been confronted by Afa the Wild Samoan, who's his father. And we, you know, we're talking on one side. Moff sneaks around the entire side of the ring without anybody noticing and slams a chair into the back of Afa the Wild Samoan. And nobody knew that this was happening. And Samu, it was his way of, you know, rejoining his family. And we beat the crap out of Samu and Afa. And we spray painted their backs yellow. And while we're doing this, fans are hopping over the guardrail. Afa's wife is coming towards us. What the hell is wrong with you guys? She's cursing up a storm. Nobody knew it was happening. And the cops had to come and hold the fans back. They legit knocked the guardrail over, tried to kill us. So this is live TV. We go to the back. TV goes off the air. Kevin Kelly, who's now a New Japan commentator, used to be for WWE. He's like, he's there, and he's like, you guys got to calm him down. You got to send him home happy. Let the Samoans beat you up. because it was legit chaos. And so we were like, all right, are we off the air? Yep. We go back out. We let Afa do his thing. We let Sam. We let Afa Jr. do this thing. Crowd couldn't be happier to watch us all die. It was like the craziest nonsense. It was legit scary, but like at the same time, I was in total Steve Mack mode. I would have punched anybody who would have stepped in front of me and not had a problem.
That's got to be an awesome feeling, too, to know that you have the fans in the palm of your hand to that extent.
It was cool. There's one time that wasn't cool, that was a little nerve-wracking, and it was kind of because there wasn't any fans around. And what happened was I was wrestling Puerto Rico by myself. I wrestled Ricky Banderas, who ended up being on Lucha Underground. He had just come back from injury, so they were looking for guys, you know, fresh faces to get him over and whatever. So I'm wrestling with him, and we're in this indoor tennis court, and there's no seats around the ring because it's inside the tennis court. But on the outside of the court, there's a fence that's posted into the ground. It's not moving. You know, it's a chain link fence. And so we go brawl, and we're closer to the crowd to get the crowd hyped up. And there was a little girl. She was standing by the fence, kneeled down by Ricky. And she's like, come on, Ricky, let's go. So I looked at her, and I brought my foot as far back as I could. Like, I touched the back of my head with my heel. And so she would see that I'm about to kick the fence. And I kicked the fence. She moves out the way. I kicked the fence real hard. Everybody starts going nuts. They start throwing rocks at me and stuff like that. So match is over. I somehow get through the crowd to get to the back. Cops escorted me and stuff. Waited a little bit. We go down the road. All the bad guys are – we stop at this restaurant, and it's a fast food Hispanic place. Like, it's a regular restaurant, but, you know, fast food. And I'm waiting online, and this lady comes up to me, and she looks at me. Perfect English. She's like, excuse me, were you the one that wrestled tonight against Ricky Banderas? And I was like, yeah, I was. And so, like, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, this is probably one of my mom's cousins, or, you know, because we got family out there. And she's like, oh, you know that little girl that you kicked by the fence? And I was like, yeah. And she was like, well, I just want to let you know that next time you're here, if you do that again, she opens up her purse and pulls out this, like, 8-inch blade, this knife. She goes, this is going to go inside of you. I just want to let you know. And then walks away. And, like, I was like, what? But, like, the crazy thing is because, like, you know, in Puerto Rico, they have mountain people and they have city people. And you figure the mountain people are going to react like that because they live up in the mountains. They're a little wacky, a little behind on the times. You know what I mean? They believe that it's real. This lady spoke perfect English, very educated, you could tell. Not like any of the crazy nonsense that you would expect, threatened to put a blade into me. So, like, I was like, whoa, this is real. But again, she would have gotten punched if she would have come at me with that knife.
So since we're talking weapons, let's talk our favorite video game.
Oh, God. Okay.
Let's talk a little up, up, down, down, left, right, BA, BA, select, start.
Yes, sir.
Those of you that are not in the know, it's Contra. Why is it the most amazing, like, first-person shooter game ever? Because I believe it is.
I have very fond memories of me and Loki because, you know, we're cousins. We grew up like brothers. We live a few blocks away from each other. Very fond memories of weekends playing Contra together, beating it multiple times in a row. Like, the nostalgia of it and what it meant to my childhood is just, it can't be topped. It's something that we could play together, we could play one-on-one, test each other. It's hard as hell. And unless you're using that code, you're not beating that game. You know what I mean?
No shot.
Yeah, the music, the sounds, the visuals, just, it brings back good, wholesome memories to me. And I'll play it now. And it still has the same effect, you know. It's just something that I know that other people have as the same way that I cherish it. There are other people who cherish it, and that's kind of cool, you know, that we were part of something at the same time. Because back then, there wasn't internet. Back then, cable TV wasn't more than 50 channels, you know. And when you had your Nintendo, which, by the way, I didn't have a Nintendo until later on in life. I used my cousin's Nintendo. I had a Sega Genesis and a Sega Master System, so I was the Sega guy. But, you know, having that Nintendo at his house and playing it, it was something special, you know. And then his father would play too, so like the three of us, we all bonded over it. And just everything about the game, just, you know, you could have the machine gun and have a million bullet shoot, or you could have the spread and cover everything. Or, you know, obviously the fire sucked, laser was worse, but you know, but spread and machine gun, obviously when you had those, it was hard to beat you, you know. And it was just an amazing game. I just, everything from, you know, the sounds of the bombs being launched from the trees in the ice stage, and that one boss that looked like a DJ robot, you know what I mean? And he would jump, kick, and throw a disc at you. And, like, you know, like, it's just awesome, you know. And then the last level being a total ripoff of Aliens and Predator. And it was like, damn, this game is great. And then Super Contra came out, and it was just like, oh, even better, you know. And it's one of those things that I don't think it'll ever die for me. Like, until I'm gone, it's going to be in my heart as something that I look at very fondly.
Oh, without a doubt. It was, to me, it was like one of the last shooting games that I really got into. Mm-hmm. I played a little GoldenEye, but like in today's video games, stuff's too real for me. I don't want to go around shooting people. Like, yeah. I don't. You know, I'm a New York City teacher. Somehow I think it would be frowned upon. Not sure why, but yeah, I think it would be.
I think, though, if you are a New York City teacher, you should have some shooting skills for real.
Yeah, listen, I get those kids to eat out of the palm of my hand because I treat them the way that they're supposed to be treated. I treat them as if they're my own kids. Mm-hmm. I love those kids, and I wouldn't trade my day job for anything in the world. It's that New York pride that you talked about in that respect, you mm-hmm. know, like, and knowing that my students, and because I'm good at what I do, I get the kids that are the quote-unquote worst of the worst, the kids with no credits that are upperclassmen, and magically I get them to pass classes. It's amazing how that happens when you can motivate somebody. But they need those role models, and they don't see them enough. So guys like yourself, guys like Low Key, you know, seeing people be successful is so important. You know, it's not just Major League Baseball, or, you know, and I work at Lehman, so we've had a couple Major League ball players mm-hmm. come out, but they need to see that other people are successful too, coming from the same type of place that they came from. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's what gets forgotten.
Yes.
Way too much. But yeah. back to the Contra piece, you know, our good buddy Greg over there wasn't allowed to play Contra.
Why is that, Greg?
Okay. So this is some deep rooted family shit. Okay,
hey, that's pretty dope. I love Barcade, by the way.
Oh, thanks. This is my bachelor party shirt. We went here for my bachelor party.
Which one, Jersey City?
No, in Williamsburg.
Oh, Williamsburg. All right. Yeah. So, I forget that in New York.
So when Contra came out, of course we are Nintendo children, all of us mm-hmm. here in this room. I really wanted to play it, and my mom thought it had everything to do with like the Iran-Contra scandal. And because my uncle at the time was like a missionary down in South America. Mm-hmm. So he had to see a lot of this stuff up close with, you know, in Guatemala and things like that. And she thought this game had something to do with that and somehow supported the insurgencies in South America. Like, little did she know it was about like aliens and stuff. So I was like kind of banned from playing it. But of course I am a resourceful young man, and I had it. I played it. I snuck it into the house, and yeah, the rest is video game history. But I got around. We all had to do that. Like, it's slight rebellion, but you gotta, you know, if your parents tell you no about something, especially something so stupid, because like I remember having the talk with her and being like, "Ma, I have no idea what you're talking about. I just want to shoot some aliens. Like, it's really not that big of a deal. Like, I can play it at other kids' houses. Like, why not home, you know, but that was it really. And, but I got around it. I think I snuck it in somehow. Like one of my friends was done with it and like gave it to me.
I'm pretty sure I gave it to
you. No, it wasn't you. I know it wasn't you.
No,
it wasn't you.
I used to trade games all the time.
Yeah, no, it wasn't you. So it was, I kind of snuck it in through like a box of a different game.
That's so fun.
And that was.
And yes, we have been friends that long.
Yeah. It's possible, but I know it wasn't you.
That's all.
We've been friends for 34 years.
See, that's awesome. That's like me and Low Life Louie and Mace Mendoza from Christopher Street Connection and Loki. Us four alone, we've known each other since the fifth grade. you know, Louie, I met my freshman year in high school, but Mace, I knew when I was in the fourth grade, he was in the fifth grade. And in our area, surprisingly, there's a lot of wrestlers who went on to do, you know, some sort of TV work or whatever. And we all knew each other. And it was kind of crazy that we all came. I felt like it was the new generation of West Texas Outlaws, you know, which is something that Homicide's always joking about. But by the way, Greg, had you been in Europe, you would have been able to play it. It would have just been named Probotector and you would have been a robot instead of... you know, red or blue guy.
The curse of growing up in a cool place like New York. Yeah. You know, you had to get.
Probotector.
Oh my god! Like this, our generation is like the coolest generation because we got all of the best stuff at the best ages. I love talking about that because like when Nintendo came out, I was like six. You're just like, oh crap, video games, all right. And I played Atari at my cousin's house and all this stuff. And then as you get older, then Sega comes out. And when I got to high school, I got PlayStation early because my sister was an intern at Sony, which was like right in New Jersey.
Yeah.
So she got like a PlayStation for me on the cheap. And Chris had the N64, so I was always over there. Remember when we found it in the closet?
Yeah.
Before Christmas. Before Christmas.
Oh yeah.
Oh man, Christmas couldn't come fast enough.
I feel like for a long time we got a new system every year between my brother and I.
Because they came out every year. I remember you had GameCube.
Yes.
Did you have GameCube?
No, we had Sega Saturn. Yeah, Sega Saturn that came out with like three games.
That didn't come up, that didn't take off.
Forever. And then immediately went back to N64.
Yeah. Saturn didn't blow up here. There are some great games. Trust me, I have my Sega Saturn 4 feet away from me at all times. But if you have the Japanese one, there were so many games that came out. And I love my Sega Saturn. It'll always be one of my... I got it. So, they always talk about that was Sega's first big screw-up was releasing the Sega Saturn months before they were supposed to. And I got my Sega Saturn the week that it came out in May. I actually had gotten X-Men Children of the Atom because I knew I was going to get it because it's around my birthday. And I had gotten the game a week before the system even came out. Like, I had a little bit of insider information that it was coming out that early. But so I got the game for myself, and then I was waiting for my dad to get me the system. And then when I finally, when it came out early, he was like, oh, all right. And he just picked it up, and I was like, yes. And, like, I was sitting there for, like, a week with no system, just looking at the back of the CD, looking at the front, reading the book over and over again. I was like, I can't wait. You know what I mean? Like, I'm that much of a mark for the Saturn. So.
Awesome.
Yes.
That is awesome. I like joking with my parents because they'll be like, you're almost 40 years old, and you're playing PlayStation 4. And I'm like, well, yeah. When we got Nintendo, you and like my parents and my uncle and aunt stayed at my house till 5 a.m. playing Super Mario Brothers because to them it was the coolest thing ever. And then my brother and I wake up 30 minutes later and they got like no sleep Christmas night, but that was their choice. So how are you judging me when you did the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, We were that generation that where home consoles just took over everything. And, you know, a lot of us lived through that. And, you know, yeah, there's some that, you know, I've got better things to do than play video games. But then one day they open up the closet and they find their old system. And oh, man, this is awesome. And then, you know, the sickness begins again.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, the first thing I bought with my wedding money was a PlayStation 4.
I believe it.
And I'll never forget that negotiation, because my wife was, I think her sister was up. We were living up in Boston. My sister-in-law came to visit, and they were going shopping on whatever that stretch of great shops down in downtown Boston is. And she was like, "Oh, I'm taking X amount of money." I'm just like, "Well, what do I get? Like, this is, you're going to buy a $500 purse right now." Mm-hmm. I'm sitting at home by myself. She's like, "Whatever." I was like, "I really want a PlayStation 4. And she's just like, "Really?" And my sister-in-law, like a boss, helped with those negotiations. Uh-huh. Like, she was like, "Just let him have it. Like, whatever, it's fine." So I'm like, "Okay, cool." And I went to the Best Buy that was we lived next door to a mall. I went to the Best Buy at the mall and I bought it. And I remember the guy that tried to sell me on it. You know how those Best Buy guys are. They're always trying to sell you on some shit. And he's trying to convince me to get a Xbox One instead. And I'm almost like, "Stop." I was like, "I had two different Xbox 360s that got the Red Ring of Death. Mm-hmm. I am not going to get hurt again." Legit what I said to him. I was like, I cannot take that kind of hurt anymore. I was like, "I will take a PlayStation 4 and I still have it. That was six years ago now, and I love every second of it. It's like the best thing ever, and I'm really looking forward to not being able to afford a PlayStation 5 when it comes out later."
Yeah, me too. Just for the back,
my wife actually bought me my PlayStation 4. When she found out I couldn't get Madden for PlayStation 3, she was like, "All right, I'll go get you a PlayStation 4. Just left the house and came back with it. Yeah. I came back from practice, and there it was. I was like, "Get out of here."
I bought it for the Batman game. That was the last Batman, Arkham Knight. That's why I bought it.
I was just having a conversation today about the Batman games on the PS4, but my favorite Batman experience is Batman on the VR. I love the VR. It's very underrated. I hate that they're not making a bigger push of it. Obviously now with the PS5, you got to wait until that comes out before they start pushing VR again. But there's so many games that are really awesome, and Batman is definitely one of the coolest experiences on VR, and it's totally worth it for that alone. The only thing I don't like is that sometimes when you do throw certain things, it won't respond as well. But there's another game called Super Hot for the VR. And Super Hot is, I mean, it's the most insane game. I love it. When I start playing it, I'll go hours without stopping. And I was explaining to one of the guys that I work with that, that if Super Hot would have been Batman, there would have been nothing that could compete with it, because it's just insane, I love Batman.
Yeah. Those are the best games, and anything Batman, I'm good with. Yeah. It's all right. But
one superhero I know.
But that's the thing, is when you look back at guys in our age brackets, like I said, and it goes back to wrestling. We grew up in the best times to be wrestling fans.
Yep.
Because, and I say this all the time on the show, it's we were kids in the 80s when it was Hogan and Warrior and Savage and all these great crazy characters that are larger than life, real life superheroes. And then we're in high school during the Attitude Era, when you're rebelling, and then your heroes are the NWO, because you're and DX and Stone Cold, and you're looking at all this stuff, and that's the people you want to be, because that's how you feel as a teenager. And it's we've had the best of everything when it comes to pop culture and our fandoms. We've just got a little bit of taste of everything, and that's why it's I'm so lucky that we were kind of born in this era, because we got the best of all the worlds, not just some of them.
I would hate to be a wrestling fan starting now. I remember seeing signs when I was a kid, Roddy Piper has AIDS, and the Iron Sheik being a character spitting on the United States, and all of those classic characters. See, what a lot of people do now is, "No, you're stereotyping and blah blah blah," and they're right to a certain extent, but at the same time, part of the reason why they were such great heels was because they inspired everyone else to be better Americans. And I don't mean that in we're better than the rest of the world, but it inspired some strength and I guess a sort of nationalism, you know, where we weren't going to let anybody come in and try to knock us down. It didn't matter what it was. We were going to stand up to whatever evil force. At that time, there was a lot of bad people around the world, including the United States. But we lived in the United States, so we can't be the bad guys, you know. But we can root and stand up against the bad guys. And, you know, like, yeah, sure, maybe a Kamala was a bad African stereotype. But at the same time, things weren't so serious. It was very comic book-ish, and everybody was into comic books. People who watched wrestling back then were the older 60s, 70s, 80s, and then you had the young kids who were coming up, and it wasn't just about, you know, that you could just, you know, watch wrestling, be under. You believed in it. You felt it. It was something that connected with a nerve. And whereas now, because everybody is so PC, very much, you know, and some of it's good, some of it's bad, you know, because if you get too much of something, obviously it's going to be bad, you know, but you can't enjoy it, you know, and whenever somebody says, you know, is, oh, that's too bad of a stereotype, it's entertainment, you know. If you're going to do a movie about slaves, obviously you're going to have to do bad white people being slave owners. And, you know, the whole story is to be inspiring. You're not going to yell at Leonardo DiCaprio for being a slave owner in a movie. So why are you going to do it to a wrestler? You know, he's just playing his part to entertain. And, yeah, there are certain things where, you know, like I said, certain things are done in bad taste. So that's why people are able to criticize and be like, no, 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 you can't do that. You can't do that. But at the same time, it's still entertainment. And if you look at wrestling as what it is, it's a performance. It's like going to Broadway and watching a play. That's why when people are like, I can't have this guy having a show on my territory and this person having a show. Broadway has how many plays within a certain amount of blocks? And they're all competing for the same amount. So if they can do it, indie wrestling can do it. WCW, WWE, yeah, they were fighting, whatever. They were in the same country. It wasn't like the same block, but, you know, whatever. But, like, there's a lot of these indie companies that they're like, we're fighting for the same ground. Doesn't matter if you're in Jersey, New York, Connecticut, whatever. If there's a place big enough to hold the ring, you could have a show. Who cares if it's your territory? There are no territories now, you know? Yeah. And everybody can make money. You just have to be crafty and have a hustle. If you have your hustle, you're going to make money no matter who's competing against you. And, you know, I feel like because there are so many people who are participation trophy winners, they ruin a lot of things. I'm saying that in the nicest way possible. You see that, right?
But
I can jerk about it, but I'm saying it in the nicest way possible.
But that's
they ruin a lot of things.
They do, and I think the problem I have with some of how fans react nowadays is this: they go out of their way to worry about what's going on in their creative process instead of just watching it for what it is. Mm-hmm. Like they'll be like, oh, that match was good, but I don't like how so-and-so is booked. And that's like a word that makes my skin crawl when people say it like that. Yes. And I think,
and you're burying him.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what burying is, stupid.
Yeah. I love Brian Pillman Jr.'s response today. Yeah. I guess the fan said to him
he was
getting buried, and he's like, I've lost to two of the most successful people on AEW. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Like, but that's the problem. It's they have like the smart fans, quote unquote, is just they have to be a part of it, and they have to fart out their opinions all the time instead of just being fans. And like when I was a kid, and I'm sure you were the same way, watching wrestling and all that stuff, was I never cared how guys were booked. I never knew. I didn't know what that meant. I was just like, it's a show. Oh, they lost the match. Big deal. Oh, I can't wait to see him try and get back at this guy for beating his ass or something like that. Like, it's just make me feel something, make me sit at the edge of my seat, make me cheer, make me angry, whatever, make me laugh, make me cry, make me feel something, and you got me. Like, that's what's cool about it. But the problem is, like, and I'll use this analogy, and since you're kind of you're on the inside, so I know you'll maybe understand what I'm trying to get at. Wrestling now is what beer has become, where you have, and I know this is a little off the beaten path, but hear me out. So, like, you know, you got your independents, which are all these microbrews that are everywhere, where you have the horned rim glasses telling you about notes of caramel and things and trying to be make it something it isn't, when it's just like, is the beer good or not? Stop. Like, that's that's all you got to tell me. I don't care about anything else. And then you have, like, WWE, which is like, you know, it's your Bud Light, but, like, people make fun of it because it's watered down and terrible. But, like, you know what? Sometimes you're thirsty and I want to just drink something that I'm familiar with. Then, you know, AEW, which is the White Claw of things, it's the new kid on the block. It is also delicious and and colorful and nice and refreshing. But the other side, like, what am I, like, I'm drinking flavored water. It's the same thing. Like, what are you doing? So that's how I see it now. And I'm maybe you can help me out, be my therapist. Am I crazy?
No, not at all.
Okay. Because it's just
perfectly, because wrestling, and I was saying this the other day, wrestling is different flavors for different people. And that's what makes wrestling great. At the same time, though, those same extremist fans who, AEW is the ultimate product. Okay, AEW hasn't existed but a year yet. So give it time to let it be the ultimate product. Right now, the proven choice is WWE because they have 9,000 years of history. At the same time, if you don't like that, you could go watch New Japan. If you don't like New Japan, you could go watch the indies. If you don't like indie wrestling, go watch some deathmatch wrestling. Go watch GCW, ICW. There's a lot of different things to watch. You want to be entertained with acrobatics? Watch Mexico. Mexico, they all do lucha. They all fly. I mean, there's so many different things. If you want to see strong style, watch Europe. Guys like Walter dominating, you know what I mean, with their strong style. So, like, there's no wrong answer for wrestling and why you like it. What there is, though, is people who are extremely over opinionated, who believe that their opinion is the ultimate, you know, opinion, and nothing else matters, nothing else can exist. And when you have that, that's when it becomes a problem. That's when outsiders who are casual fans watch, they go, you know, I just saw AEW and, you know, Sonny Kiss wrestled Cody Rhodes. This Sonny Kiss, that's pretty cool that they got this gay black dude wrestling for a main title. You don't see that everywhere. Let me look up Cody Rhodes and AEW and see what else they got. And then you'll see the stands who, oh, AEW buried Sonny Kiss and AEW. No, it's pro wrestling. But, you know, if you're a casual fan, you see all that extreme attitude. You're going to be like, ah, this is still kids nonsense. I'm not going to watch. And you lose money. So, they, you know, I appreciate the passion of the fans. And it's cool because I know that, you know, I'm not everybody's cup of tea. But the fans that love me, they love me, you know. And it's cool that there's people who are like that. But at the same time, you got to chill and understand that. Again, like I said it before, this is just entertainment. We're not changing the world. We're just providing an escape. When you could understand that, then it makes a world of difference, you know. Nice. But it's like that for a lot of things. It's like that for NASCAR. It's like that for, you know, movies and plays and books. And there's always going to be stands, no matter what, who take it too far. And it just so happens that with wrestling, there's a lot of stands. See, that, and it gets annoying.
That's the thing. It's like I always use this comparison, too. It's like I'm a Yankee fan. I hate Yankee fans. They annoy me. Because they're spoiled rotten, and they don't appreciate some of the things that go into, like, baseball. They're so overcritical. They just want they're never happy. It doesn't matter. And I think that's some of the poison that has gotten into wrestling now. It's that the fans are never, you're never going to make everybody happy. The reason why AEW is on, like, this upswing with people is because they're so young. They haven't disappointed you yet. They haven't ripped your heart out with something that's crazy. Like, WWE is, I could probably count, like, we can have whole shows about times where they let us down, but you can have a million more where it was the greatest thing you ever saw. And you have just have to be able to appreciate what you have in front of you, because right now it really is a great time to be a wrestling fan. The problem is people have forgotten how to be wrestling fans and they're missing out.
They all want to be part of the magic. And this is what I was going through before. Yeah. Said that wrestling is like being a magician. If they know what your tricks are, then they're going to want to try to do it better than you. But the problem is the fans that want to try, or they give their opinion, they haven't done it to where they can have an honest opinion, you know. And you could say John Madden's the greatest football coach to never play football, and you'd be 1,000% right. But at the same time, he put in his time from when he was a young assistant coach to when, you know, the last game that he coached, what was that, like 60 years almost, 50 years, whatever it was. And then he added to being, you know, a commentator. His perspective was that of someone who was a master of the game. Not all of us are masters in pro wrestling, but there's a guys who have spent enough time, have seen enough that they can be. Whereas some fan who started watching maybe last year, like for me, if you started watching during the Attitude Era, you're not really a fan. You're just someone who caught it on while it was hot. And that was over 20 years ago. You know what I mean? Because I go back to the Hogan days, and I go back to the Iron Sheik and Roddy Piper. You know what I mean? When there were no pay-per-views, you know. And for me, there's fans who are older than that who look at me as not being a wrestling fan for that long, even though it's almost 40 years. You know what I mean? But, like, there's so many different, you know, things to watch and things. Just if you love what it is that you love, praise it, put it over, have other people experience it. Not everybody's gonna like it, not everybody's gonna love it. Some people will love it, some people won't. But don't trash other things. Like, I hate when people are like, oh, deathmatch wrestling sucks. It's not something that I would do, but I respect the hell out of all of those guys, and I love watching what they do and what they put themselves through. And most of them can actually wrestle. They just prefer to do deathmatch wrestling and put the story behind that. And I appreciate that, you know. Then there's some wrestling that I watch, I'm like, oh, that looks like video game wrestling. You know, they take a hit, they bump, they get right back, they hit a move. Like, nah, it doesn't work that way. It's a story. It's a masterpiece that you have to put together. And a lot of people don't understand that. And they think, you know, the video game wrestling style, and to be fair, like, that's the old Young Buck style where, you know, they hit a million moves and kick out of. Some people love that. I'm not a huge fan of it, but I'll watch it and I'll enjoy it. I know where it's coming from. You know, I understand the history of what they're trying to emulate. So I appreciate what they're trying to do. I just don't really care that it's being put out there sometimes, because it gives people the wrong perception of what being a pro wrestler is, you know. But then again, I'm also an older generation guy. So what I feel is from 20 years ago, all these kids coming up now are being taught differently. So I have to be able to be open-minded to what they're being taught and presented, whether I agree with it or not. You know, because if I have to work some of these guys, I'm not going to go and change my style, but I'll adapt to make it more fluid for the both of us. And a lot of guys and girls really don't understand that concept yet. It's picking up a little bit, but it's not everywhere, you know, because there's a lot of guys who are just like, ah, screw all this nonsense. I won't do nothing for them. I'm not going to work with them. Who's making money? Who benefits? I'd rather work with the young guys and show them, let them have their style, but show them what I know and they can apply it. That's why guys like LAX are so good. They're the younger generation who can do flips and who can do, you know, shoot across the ring in one bound. You know what I mean? But they know how to tell a story and how to make everything presented in a way that everybody can believe it. And I think that's what something that's lost in wrestling is, if people see that you're taking 10 hits in a row and you're getting up, none of those hits before that mean anything. But if you take one good punch, because in a real fight, if someone punches you one time, I mean, we see it in MMA all the time, someone gets dropped with a punch, they're done for 2 minutes at least, you know, with their eyes in the back of their head, with everybody around, you're right, trying to wake them up. In wrestling, you never see that. It's always bang, 10 seconds at the most. You know, you're up to your next series. You know, you got to learn to appreciate. And trust me, I'm not the one that was like born like that. I did my stupid stuff too. You know what I mean? But a lot of them have to understand to slow it down and understand the importance of what they're doing and why. And then when you have that, then the fans can watch and be like, oh, I get it now. You know, and yeah, it just, it's weird because like I said, it's every generation. I was told, you got to slow down, kid. Shut up. You don't know nothing, old man. Now that I'm the old man, I understand it and I get it. And I'm trying to show it to the younger generation so that way they can understand it. Their body can be preserved and they can make money and business will be better. You know,
I think one of the things that's always stood out to me about you, Loki, Homicide, LAX now, you know, guys like Eddie Kingston, while you always portrayed this tough demeanor and but you also clearly saw that you guys love what you do. Like, and that's the piece. Like, even today, I haven't watched AEW yet, but I happened to look and I'm watching Ortiz flop around the ring because of orange juice. And I'm like, that's somebody that just loves what he's doing, period. Like, is it silly? Sure. But you know what? If it's good enough for him, who's a stud, then it's good enough for me as a fan to enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you watch guys like Captain Lou Albano, Dan Moff put me on the Captain Lou Albano. If you watch before he became the serious manager and they were using him as, you know, if someone wasn't there, if someone was late, they put Albano in with whoever, right? If you watch, nothing he did was serious. He was a serious character, but every move that he did in the ring was the most insane, like flopping around. And you could tell, though, that he loved being in the ring and he just enjoyed being in front of the crowd. And the crowd picks up on that. They always do. They know who's real and who's just doing it. That's why so many people, as great as Lex Luger was at a time, so many people take a dump all over him because you could tell it was more about the money for him. And there's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, in a business where believability and the ability to connect with the people is something that makes you more money, if he would have just been honest, I hate this business, I hate the fans, people would have probably paid a million times more to see him because they would have wanted to see him lose. But because he was a good guy and he was always with Sting and, you know, he was Captain America in the WWE, nobody believed it. They bought into it because he was the good guy. And back then, you know, you cheered for the good guy, but nobody went nuts for him. That's why they put the title on Bret Hart and not him. And you could tell that, like, he just didn't want to be there more than what he had to, you know, and people buy that. When you see Homicide, you know that there's not that much of a difference between Homicide and Nelson. Nelson loved wrestling. Nelson loved hardcore. He loved hip-hop. He loved rock. He loved Terry Funk, Bruiser Brody, Stan Hansen. Nelson loved that. And that, all of that mixed in became Homicide. And you felt that. That's why he's able to connect anywhere he goes, whether it's an all-Latino crowd, an all-white crowd, an all-black crowd. You believe that he was a guy who came from Fort Greene, Brooklyn, in the projects, because that's where he came from. That's what he is. And you feel that. And, like, there's a lot of guys who don't understand that concept. They're always trying to change into characters that they're not. And it always fails. They'll do 5 or 6 character changes before maybe that seventh character change clicks, you know, and sometimes you just never click. Sometimes it just never happens because you can't find what you really are. Because a lot of guys who get into this business are really young, 16, 17, 18. You don't know who you are. But once you have a grasp of who you are, for me, being from Brooklyn, being from New York, being into a guy like Vader and Rick Rude and Macho Man and just, you know, the Road Warriors and the Samoans and the Steiners, like all that stuff made me Steve Mack. You know, Stephen Carrasquillo loves video games, and that's the one thing that I really haven't integrated into my wrestling because there's no real place for it with my character. My character's a brawler from the streets who will do whatever it takes to get it done. With video games, it doesn't fit. I can't be like a TJ Perkins and have a Mega Man entrance. I would love to, trust me, if I could. But it wouldn't be real, and the people wouldn't connect with that. I could talk to you guys about playing Contra, but Contra can't be part of my wrestling. It's a separate entity. And that's one of the few things that I just, no matter what, as much as I love video games, I can't connect in wrestling and video games. It just doesn't work. But with everything else that I love Stan Hansen. Clothesline's my finish. I love Vader. I would do splashes off the top in the moonsault. You know, I love Macho Man. The wildness of his brawling technique when he did brawl, because he was a great wrestler. But a lot of people don't understand that when it came to brawling, Macho Man was one of the greatest brawlers of all time. You know, I do that. That's one of my favorite things, is to just brawl and have fun and make people believe that I'm crazy. And Macho Man was awesome at that. So, like, when you see all that stuff and then you throw in, like I said before, representing New York and how you can't be a failure. There is no room for failing if you're from New York. It's the underground underdog city for a reason. Everybody who goes to New York, they're all underdogs, and they either make it or they leave. If you stay in New York, you made it. And that's how I am with wrestling. That's how Homicide and Loki, that's how we all are. LAX, I am so proud of them, because those are two kids who really, Mike came from the projects. You know, he doesn't know any better, you know, and he's a smart kid. He's a creative guy. And Ortiz, too. Ortiz is super creative. You don't even know it, but Ortiz is a great lucha wrestler. He does all kinds of rolling and flips. He's never had a reason to show it. And when he busted out, everyone's going to be like, oh, where the hell did that come from? But he's been doing it for over 10 years now. And same thing with Mike. Mike, actually, he doesn't look like he's a bull like that. But Mike is one of the hardest hitters I've ever been in the ring with. But if you look at him, he's 6'1", probably about 210, 220. He hits like he's a 300-pound man. Sometimes we would have brawls. We would have matches where he would hit me early in the match, and we're in the locker room, and I'm still feeling it on my collarbone. Like, damn it, Mike. You know? But that's that New York in them. They got it, you know? You have to be a master of many things in wrestling, but especially when you're coming from us and representing our line, our lineage. They are the generation, the next generation of Hit Squad family and, you know, New York guys, because they were taught under us. There's a few others, like Eddie Kingston, but Eddie Kingston's a little bit older, so he comes off as part of our generation. But reality is, Eddie Kingston's the current generation. He's the one leading. That's why everybody's like, yo, Eddie's, you know, he's great on the mic. He's a great wrestler. He was around with us. He was at shows with us in Jersey All Pro and Bayonne, watching, studying. Him and his old partner, Blackjack, they were, you know, watching what we were doing, and they wanted to be where we were, and they worked hard to do it. Eddie worked hard. He left New York to go to Chikara in the Midwest or wherever else he went, and then came back to New York as the king, Eddie Kingston. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't something that happened overnight, but it happened. The same thing with guys like Chris Dickinson. Chris Dickinson, I remember him being like in high school, 13, 14 years old, coming to ask me for stuff. And he, you know, got started, got a little busy, but then his head got a little too big, and he had to go disappear for a year, and he came back. He became Chris Dickinson, the man, you know? And like I said, nobody's perfect. Everybody makes mistakes. But if you can do that and then come back and be better and learn, there's nobody that's going to stop you. It doesn't matter what. And, you know, just so happens we're from New York, and people fear us a little bit more.
Well, that whole New York contingent, where, you know, being New Yorkers, we get behind it very, very easily. I kind of want to end on this. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw you step up for Schlack. Mm-hmm. Either yesterday or today.
Yesterday.
Yeah. And to me, that was, you know, the one thing I hate about today's internet is the cancel culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like you said numerous times today, we've all made mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, if you've made a mistake and you've atoned and you've moved forward or you've learned, we can't cancel everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I saw, like, that whole New York contingent. you stepped up. Masha Slamovich, who's out in Japan now, but she's another Queens girl coming and standing tall. How does that cancel culture affect everything, and what really made you rally to support them?
So, I mean, I'll be honest. I had someone, you know, call me out on trying to shoot on them 20 years ago. And, you know, there's a whole story behind it, but it ended up, you know, nothing really came of it, thankfully. I mean, if the person wants to confront me again about it, I'll be more than happy to say something and defend myself. But at the same time, what I did, as opposed to what some of the other people were being accused of, you know, the whole speaking out movement was about sexual harassment. And in wrestling, unfortunately, there's a history of it, whether it involves, you know, females or males or kids, you know, there's a long history and it's very dark. And someone spoke out and it led to a chain of events where certain people who were predators, who messed up, got called out. And it'd probably be a long time before we hear from them again. You know, and some of them were my friends, some of them I was cool with, some of them I worked with. I wasn't there. I can't speak on, you know, the majority of things. And for me, honestly, there are a lot of people who, when they see me, they act differently. They're not going to show their true face. And I get that. I understand that, because I'm looked at as someone who became a respected leader of the locker room, whatever locker room I'm in, and someone that a lot of the younger generation comes to for advice. And I always give my honest opinion. It does suck that certain things can't be done now, where 20 years ago, 10 years ago, you could make a joke about things. Now you have to realize that there's someone that it will offend and there's someone that it will hurt. And at the same time, the one thing that makes America great, you're innocent until proven guilty, and they love a comeback story. Now, I'm not saying that some of these guys deserve a comeback story. Believe me, they don't. But someone like Schlack, who I know has lost an opportunity to be on a grander stage due to some of the people that he hung out with and used to be friends with, it cost him. And is it unfair? Yes, because it was a while ago. Having hung out with Schlack, having talked with Schlack, spent time around him, and you see that there's a whole bunch of other people who are in my same position, we're going to stick up for him. Because when people say he's a Nazi, we've never seen any of that. And again, you know, like I said, people don't show that side, their true side, to me. But we've gotten comfortable enough where we could talk. And never once did I ever suspect that he would ever, you know, try to oppress somebody or call someone, you know, like, listen, like we were saying before, you know, you messed up. We all call each other some name, whether it's the N-word or calling someone, you know, a chink, or calling someone a wop, or whatever it is that's demeaning. We've all said it, whether it's to other people or we said it to ourselves, just like in our mind or whatever it is. And some people are racist, but for the majority of it, if you're mad, you're going to say what comes to your head first. And if in the culture that we grew up in, when you have movies like Boys in the Hood, when you have movies like Menace to Society, when you hear certain words, you're going to associate certain people with certain words. It's just something that happens. It's not something to be proud of, but it happens. You know what I mean? And I'm not trying to stick up or be an apologist for anybody. I'm just saying human nature, that's how it is. If you see a fat person, you're going to call them fatty in your mind, or you say it in your mouth. Because in our society, growing up, especially during the 80s and 90s, how many times would we watch a cartoon and there'd be a fat guy walking and there'd be a trombone player? You know what I'm saying? I've been a fat guy my whole life. I've heard every fat name from every audience. I'm not black, but I've been called the N-word from fans. I've been called a spick, derogatory term for a Hispanic person, which I am. I've heard everything that you can hear from wrestling fans. Not once did I ever strike out at somebody, or not once did I ever say, hey, kick them out. And the reason being is I made an example out of them while I was in the ring. I understood what my power was. My power was, you're going to try to embarrass me. My mouth works better than yours, and I can embarrass you. And I did my job, and at the same time showed them up, because while they're trying to get everybody to think that I'm a lowlife or whatever it is, I did my job in the ring to show everybody that I'm above that. And with Schlack, I've never gotten the impression, nor has he ever led me to think, that he's a Nazi or a racist or anything to that extreme level. We've had great stories where, you know, I'm Italian, he's Italian. We shared experiences that we both had growing up. And when you think about, like, for me, growing up by Bensonhurst, it's real easy, being part Italian, part Puerto Rican, real easy to put down black people from, coming from near Bensonhurst, because back then, the Italians, that's what they did. I never did that. I didn't buy into that. But I'm just saying, it's real easy to fall in line with that, because you look up to Italians, especially, like I said, you're growing up, you meet John Gotti, you see mobsters all around. You're like, Goodfellas comes out, and all of a sudden, oh, what are you talking about, Bobby? You want to be one of them. They make an impression on you, especially for me growing up, being young in Bensonhurst. But it never once ever sank in, like, I'm going to be a racist or anything like that, because that's just not how I am. Honestly, there's good and there's bad with everybody, no matter what. All walks of life. There's not one good, clean, pure anything. Because even with dogs, we all love dogs, right? We all love puppies. Sometimes there's dogs that bite kids' face. That picture of that kid that saved his sister, dog mm-hmm. bit his face. It happens. There's good and bad in everything. Schlack does not strike me, nor has he ever struck me, as someone who is malicious, evil, racist, anything of that line. And you can ask guys like Matt Tremont and Homicide and Low Life Louie. You can ask those guys what they feel about Schlack, and I'm pretty sure they all agree with me. So when it comes to, defending, sometimes you have to defend, and you don't want to, stand against the wave, but when you see that there's someone who isn't a bad guy, sometimes you gotta fight the wave, and it sucks. But I feel like with Schlack, though, that there's enough guys who feel the same as me. It's just there's a bunch of people who saw an old article and they're like, oh, well, he's standing there with Nazi guys. He must be a Nazi. Perception is reality. And like I said, guilt by association adds to that perception. And, we're not perfect. We've all hung out with, I'm sure if you grew up in New York, I'm sure we went to high school with someone who murdered someone. Does that make us a murderer? No. But we knew someone who was a murderer. You know what I mean? Depending on what part of New York. I know a couple of guys who are in jail because they murdered people. You know what I mean? So, like, it's just one of those things where, you kind of have to stick up sometimes. Sometimes it's better left things unsaid. Because you just don't have enough knowledge, information, so it's a touchy situation. The one thing I will say, though, is that Twitter, it's given a voice to everyone. And in all fairness, not everyone knows enough to have a voice, but they don't understand that. They feel that, oh, it's my right to talk and, freedom of speech. And you're right. You do have freedom of speech. But sometimes you really have to live by, everyone thinks you're foolish until you open your mouth, and then they know that you are. And a lot of people forget that. And that's one of those things that I will hold on to for as long as I live, because I've seen it firsthand.
I mean, it draws back to, I guess, a couple months ago when the comedian called, said you had to be like retarded to like wrestling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the community just went apeshit, and that's fine, but I mean, and then they called them out for, A, they were probably insulted because wrestling fans have thick skins and have to deal with everything like that. But then also the use of that word. And I'm thinking about, and the thing I said about it when it happened was, A, as bad as it is, don't even sit there and try to tell me that you haven't said in everyday conversation, oh, that's retarded.
Yeah.
Like you've always said that. It's just, it's not right. It's just something that comes out of our mouth. Second being, as a wrestling community, you say worse things about somebody who doesn't like a similar wrestler than you than that guy said about you. So who are you kidding? So, I mean, I get all of that. And it's just, and like you said about Twitter, it's like we've all been given this power to read people's minds. That's what Twitter is. I don't want to hear everybody's thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, but you know, I do and I keep up and it's cool. And I use it more as a networking tool, like it should be, and meet new people and make new friends and be able to connect. And that's what's great about it. But also it's like, I don't want to hear every thought you fart out. Like, it's not okay. That's not cool. Like, no, stop yourself. But no, I appreciate the words that you said and the honesty that you answered that question that Chris had, because you don't get that a lot nowadays. It's everything's very whitewashed and sanitized, and honesty is where we learn. Honesty is how we heal. Honesty is how we grow. And so I just want to say that I appreciate how you answered that question, man.
Thank you. I mean, it's become a very toxic place because it becomes contagious and becomes addictive. You check out something and, oh man, what else? All right, so all these people are talking about it, and becomes fear of missing out. And once that fear of missing out, you know, takes over, then that's when people start, well, let me just put my opinion on this. And your opinion comes off of an article that you read rather than studying what it was that's being said, you know. And or it's like a snapshot of whatever it is rather than the whole thing. It's great for movements like the Black Lives Matter movement, because, I mean, while we had Rodney King in the early 90s, and Rodney King opened up a lot of people's eyes, the thing with George Floyd, I mean, that was an embarrassment to the human race that anything like that could happen, and people stood to the side. And of course, something had to be done. So for that purpose, yes. But then, like everything, it gets tainted and it becomes, well, that movement stands for this group of people and this movement stands for that people. And that's where the whole purpose of everything gets lost. And, you know, now you're starting to, you got to also remember, there's a lot of people who have been stuck at home for 4 months who are bored as hell. And they're like, well, I'm going to talk. And all right, talk. But at the same time, you know, you got to be careful, because while I do, like what we were just talking about, the word retarded. I love the word retarded, because to me, I say it all the time. I'm retarded. You know what I mean? I talk about myself that way because that's just how I grew up. Growing up in Brooklyn, and growing up in wrestling, you say, oh, that was retarded. You know what I mean? But then it became a bunch of advocates who told us that that's a bad word. And then, all right, we're going to conform. And now once they saw that we conformed to retarded, now you can't say other things, and you have to get things politically correct. And it becomes just this environment where, you know, words have so much meaning and they have so much weight when, you know, it's just words, reality. Because, like I said, I got called fat. I got called the N-word. I got called all kinds of crap. Never once did it ever make me bow down and say, they don't like me. They don't care about me. They want to hurt me, because I'm strong enough to know that it's just words. Now, if I see someone in the street and someone comes at me with evil intent, I'm going to handle my business. And I get it. Not everybody's like that, but that's just how I am. You know, I'm going to try to diffuse it and try to get people to talk it out first. But if I see, sometimes you just, it's not going to happen. So you got to take care of business, you know. Now, like I said, there's a lot of people who aren't like me. There's a lot of people now, this generation that's coming up, are all the participation trophy winners. And they don't understand what, you know, facing adversity means, because they didn't have to, because mommy and daddy took care of it, or someone else took care of it for them. And they're having this voice. What they're not realizing is, though, there's consequences. you have to face those consequences to all of your actions. It doesn't matter how big or how small. And a lot of the times, you know, they want to get things done their way, but they don't realize that it affects a whole bunch of people outside of their bubble. And when it does, they look and they're like, oh, damn, I don't know what to do. A lot of them go to drugs. A lot of them commit suicide, do whatever it is. They take the weak way out instead of facing their consequences. So it's a bad thing. And I'm sorry to get so deep on it, but I mean, that's the world that we're living in 2020, where your words on a screen and your history will come back to bite you in the ass in one way or the other. And, you know, you got to be careful what you put out there. Like I said, there was some good. It always starts with a good intention. And then it became someone else's reason to get something else done. And that's where the trouble always lies. And it doesn't matter if it's wrestling, Black Lives Matter, COVID, or anything that's going on, any hot topic in the world. It's, you know, one of those things where everybody's opinion, sometimes you got to be quiet and speak in other ways other than going on Twitter, if that makes sense.
Of course.
Absolutely does. So we always come to that point in our podcast where we're not getting anything better. and the last couple of answers you've given it just absolutely off the charts.
Thank you.
You know, like I told you off air before, you know, we were big fans coming in and even bigger fans now, and cannot thank you nearly enough for taking some time with us and talking wrestling, talking life with us. You know, it's been an incredible hour and a half, and thank you so much.
No, thank you guys. You know, like you see, I'm just a big old goof. Sometimes, you know, life does get a little serious, but that's where video games and whatever else, you know, wrestling comes in. And I'm not here to change the world. I'm just here to have fun and make people smile while I'm doing it as best as possible. And, you know, I'm really good at entertaining. I've seen over the last 23 years of wrestling, and I've been fortunate enough to travel the world. And I'm grateful for all the fans that I've got to work in front of, because they paid their ticket to come see me and they didn't have to. And, you know, it's cool that there have been times where people have asked, requested for me to be there, and you guys requested me to be on this podcast, and I'm very grateful for that, because, you know, again, I'm nobody. I'm just a fat kid from Brooklyn named Steve, you know what I mean? And it's cool how sometimes, even at your worst moments, there'll be somebody to come through and make you feel a little bit better, and you get to realize that the world isn't the worst place, and there are bad times, but they don't last. And you know, there's always going to be something there to remind you to just do better tomorrow, and you'll be all right. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Why don't you plug your social media and all that stuff for us?
Well, right now, the only social media I have is my Twitter, which is at Steve Mack, DHS, MACK, because everybody likes to spell it MAC, and I'm like, it's not mac and cheese. It's Mac, like Mac's Mac. But what you call it? It's just my Twitter. I probably will be reopening a Facebook. I used to have my Facebook used to be really awesome. And then, you know, it just got too toxic and I had to shut it down. And I was just using Twitter to just promote things. But, you know, I'm probably going to bring back some form of Facebook eventually, just depending. And to be honest, you know, as I'm seeing the light at the end of the tunnel for my career, I have a lot of great memories, and I would definitely like to share all of them. Not all of them, but most of them, the bigger ones. And, you know, just have a place for, like, my daughter to see what her dad has done over the last, you know, 2 decades and some of the cool stuff that I've been able to do. And hopefully it'll inspire her to live her dream, because, you know, honestly, growing up, I didn't have any dreams. I liked football, I liked baseball, basketball. I played them all. Wrestling was always the consistent, whether it was my grandfather, my uncle, my cousin, whatever. We all love wrestling. And the fact that my cousin and I were able to become what we became in wrestling and represent New York, represent Brooklyn, represent our families in the way that we have, it means more than anything that we've gotten. through wrestling and anything else. And it's kind of cool that, you know, him and I get to share that experience. You know, there have been times we butted heads, but ultimately we're still two kids from Brooklyn. And anytime we get to meet up with each other, it's like we're kids again. And it's kind of cool that wrestling affords us that opportunity to share that experience, you know? So I'm very grateful. And like I said, thank you guys for having me on.
Absolutely, our pleasure. So you can follow us at DDT Archives on both Twitter and Instagram. You can follow me, Chris, on Twitter at Chris_DDTHSLB. And we're going to keep bringing you the best interviews, point blank, period. You know, we're New York born, New York bred, and one day we'll be lucky enough to be New York dead.
Yes, sir.
Leave it there.
Yes, sir.